morning, diners and travelers of the world. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And good morning, Peter.
Good morning. Ann's a little quiet this morning. I'm going to have to raise her volume.
You told me I was blasting the roof off the place.
Well, you were a second ago. Now you went shy again. Anyway,
gentle.
We
have some good guests.
We always have good guests.
Yeah, this next guy is a real revelation. Part of a new breed called the celebrity farmer. This is, of course, you know, the celebrity chef. So let's just listen to Tim Stark.
How often do you find a tomato farmer who is also a very, very literary, fine writer? Well, we have one, Tim Stark. Welcome to On the Menu.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and your book is Heirloom, Notes from an Accidental Tomato Farmer. It's really a memoir about how you live and how you balance your life. Tell our listeners what your concept was in writing this.
Yeah, I think I was about 10 years into being an heirloom, being a tomato farmer, really growing a lot of heirloom varieties of tomatoes. And I sort of looked back over the 10 years and I thought, you know, there's a real story here to tell about how I fell into this, because I started out, I was a struggling writer in Brooklyn living on the fourth floor of a brownstone, and I just got this idea in my head. I was going to start 3,000 tomato seedlings and in my apartment in Brooklyn, and eventually, of course, I had to take them back to Pennsylvania, eastern Pennsylvania, where I grew up, and plant them into the ground, because I certainly wasn't going to let 3,000 tomato seedlings die in my brownstone.
But you went off and on a whim, you bought the stuff. In a way, I sort of did. Maybe this sounds bad, but it's sort of like
getting a girl pregnant or something. Now you got to raise the baby and do everything. Well, I got a girl who had 3,000 tomato seedlings pregnant, you know, and now I had to be a good father to them. Was sort of how it started, and
It's really a story, though, focused on your development as a person too.
Oh yeah, certainly.
Yeah. And developing an identity.
Mm-hmm. I've learned so much from that responsibility. You know, beginning with those 3,000 tomato seedlings, and now this year I have 20,000 tomatoes in the ground. I've learned an enormous amount, including how to finish a book.
I was wondering, with all that farming, when you had time to do a book.
A lot of it got written. Some of it was fun, because some of it I literally wrote right after the events happened. For instance, there was an essay I wrote about a groundhog.
Oh, that is funny. I mean, listeners, for no other reason, you get this book because it's probably the funniest. That'll become a classic, Tim.
Yeah, yeah. And that was one of the fastest. I wrote that so quickly because I basically wrote everything that happened,
published in Gourmet Magazine, right?
Yeah, it was published in Gourmet Magazine 2 years ago. That was when I was really getting started with the book, and it was published in Gourmet Magazine, and other parts of the book took a long time. There was a couple of the essays I wrote in the wintertime, and those were sort of the long, I call them the long, lugubrious ones. It seemed one essay was about 40 pages, the second essay about Eckerton, which is where I grew up and where
Yeah, let's mention started. It's Eckerton Hill Farm in Lenhartsville.
Lenhartsville, Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania,
right?
Which is the eastern part of the state.
Is that in Lancaster County, Tim?
No, it's actually Berks County.
Okay.
Oh, it is Berks.
It's
right next door.
Yeah, yeah. You're probably thinking Lancaster because I write a lot about
the
Mennonite farmers that
the
I became
Mennonite.
Friends
no,
with.
No, I mean, it just happens to be the one of the richest agricultural regions in the whole world.
Yeah.
It's really funny. I went there in 1972. I was doing some non-farming related work in the United States for the first time, and somebody said, you should go to Lancaster County for the weekend and look at all the farmers. And I said, well, that sounds like a silly idea.
Uh-huh.
But it turned out that it was a whole lot of fun. It was like turning pages of history back 500 years.
And oh, yeah.
Watching
yeah.
the way it used to be done. I got to go back to the groundhog thing now. I don't want to give the story away, because people should at least Google Gourmet Magazine to find the article. But suffice it to say that it was not an entirely happy ending for the groundhog.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. And
but he got what he deserved.
Well, in a way, and it was funny because I think here's something I find myself doing a lot when I write is I like finding little hypocrisies, and here was a hypocrisy of my own that I was this sort of kind-hearted, gentle farmer that, you know, just sort of got into it from writing, and I was always kind to the animals in my field, and, you know, I had never killed a groundhog in 10 years of farming or a deer or anything, and all of a sudden this groundhog, he did something really, he just got to me, he just really got under my skin.
I understand completely.
And he meant
right.
A very unhappy ending, and I'm not proud of the way it ended, but...
See,
you know.
I don't know why that's any worse than poisoning or shooting or, I don't know.
My cousin is a, by way of being, I guess you would call him a farmer in Tasmania, and his wife likes to plant bulbs, so she planted these wonderful bulbs, and then this rascal called a bandicoot came along.
Bandicoot.
A bandicoot, it's a sort of,
like a rodent.
Sort of like a marsupial groundhog, if you want to categorize it.
Just that name, bandicoot, I can imagine.
Funny, yeah.
The dreaded bandicoot.
They tried all kinds of ways to catch this thing.
Yeah, they never caught the bandicoot, but it sure got this just stopped planting good bulbs. It was the only thing to do.
Oh yeah. Oh, I think every farmer has a story like this too. Mike Madison, who wrote a book called Blythe Tomato, talks about the gophers, and I think it's bulbs that they get in his field, or is it bulbs, or maybe the olive tree?
Bulbs they really like.
Yeah, yeah.
So Tim, I mean, you are a farmer, but let's get the record straight that you are really a writer, and I mean, you have published in Gourmet, Condé Nast, Traveler, The Washington Post, the Organic Gardening, and so forth. I mean, the gardening provides a lot of your subject matter, but your style is very rich. I mean, your sense of words is just wonderful.
Yeah, I was an English major, and I was, as I said, I was always a struggling writer. And I published way back. I published in the literary magazines, Missouri Review, and places like that. So
I told you one of my most favorite things. I mean, the whole book is filled with just beautifully imaged, just everything, narrative, just beautiful. But this one is like what you do with words. Here's an example. When the sun is burning holes through the afternoon, isn't that just gorgeous, huh? The tomato plants soak up light until they are limp with molten exhaustion. Now, that's gorgeous.
Yeah. That's funny because that line, I like it that you picked out that line because that, to me, captures almost everything that I have to say about the tomato. There's a lot of... The tomatoes, what makes a really good tomato, and I always say it's sort of that suffering from being under that sun and the sun beating down on it. And, you know, our fields are canted. They're sort of southern-facing hills that get sun all day long, and we can never get enough water on those plants.
Now
tomatoes just get beaten down, and that's, I always say it's sort of tomato suffering brings, and character brings out the flavor.
Well, that's what they do with grapes in Spain and other regions, too.
Yeah.
Life as a grape is tough. Life as a tomato on Tim's farm is pretty tough, I guess. But
I had a food writer was here once, and he said he walked through and he said it reminded him of, I think, was it in France, the grapes in France, the way that, it literally is that you see them droop. They, at the end of the day, it's like molten exhaust, just droop with sort of, you know, they've just had it. They're like, they're ready for that sun to just go away.
Isn't the history of the tomato itself is really very interesting when, you know, people used to think the seeds were poisonous?
Yeah, it really is.
When you're actually riding a movement at this point, I mean, we've had celebrity chefs, and now we're having celebrity farmers, and you are a celebrity farmer, very well known for your writing as well as your tomatoes. So how does that feel?
Yeah, it feels good, I guess.
The timing is perfect.
Know, part of the wanting to be a writer is you know, there's some ego involved, and I guess I guess maybe I'm a little vain about my tomatoes sometimes. I think I talk about them in the books. It's sort of, I feel like my tomatoes, I've been through that same sort of, you know, I'm out in that sun with those tomatoes all day long, you know. So I'm limp with molten exhaustion at the end of the day too. And there's, I guess, there's, at the end of the day, there's a lot of pride that comes with having gone through that and having, and for my tomatoes. So,
now tell me this: did you ever get diagnosed? Do you have Lyme disease?
There's a couple of doctors in the area that have said that, you know, there's exhaustion and sort of achiness that quite a few other farmers have. Did you read that? So I did for a while.
I read this book, and you talk about that.
Yeah.
You left some cliffhangers here. I mean, are you still married?
I am. I'm still married, yeah.
Okay.
It's hard, though. It's hard. I mean, the family, it's hard to... My wife was a lawyer in New York City, and we both moved back. When I first started farming, it was the two of us doing sort of everything.
Right.
And then she sort of got exhausted, and we had two children. And it just ain't the way it used to be, the old family farm. It's tricky. It's hard. The work is the work, I think, is very good for, actually, in a lot of ways it's good for my health to be out in the sun and to be working, but the tomato season's just nonstop. It's endless, and it's hard on my family. It's hard on everything. It's hard on but we're still married. We're still moving along, trying to figure out, you know, happy mediums for a lot of things. Sometimes I think maybe I should cut back how many tomatoes I grow, but it seems each year I have a higher demand for my tomatoes.
Uh-huh.
Even though everyone else is growing more heirloom tomatoes too, it just seems so. If I had to cut back, I don't know who I would say no to.
why did we finish up, Tim, with the wonderful story that was just published in AARP magazine,
okay,
about Cherokee purple?
Oh, Cherokee purples. Yeah, well, I think everything we've talked about leads into that. In the first couple of years, because I make a living off the tomato. I'm raising a family of four off the tomatoes, so I'm waiting.
You have four now?
Sorry?
You have four?
Oh, children?
Yeah. Oh, and you still have two?
Two girls, 8 and 10, no more.
All right.
No, I'm not raising one of those farm families, because I'm working hard so my kids don't have to farm. You know, I'm three generations back. So,
uh-huh. But, so go ahead, back to the story.
Okay, so the Cherokee purple is always, and you know, for those of you who are looking for a good early ripening heirloom tomato, Cherokee purple is great, and I plant a lot of them for that reason, because as soon as they come in, I have huge demand for them. But 3 years in a row, I don't know how I did this. It's sort of like this weird mental tick in my mind that I made the same mistake 3 years in a row. The first time I picked them, I put them in the weeds, because that's all I had around my plants, because I didn't spray the weeds, and I put lots of the Cherokee purples in the weeds, and I proceeded to back over them with a pickup truck. And this is the one thing in the world I wanted to preserve, because they were already sold. I could have, these are tomatoes, the very first tomatoes of the year, if you know, they're worth a lot of money. And I did that 3 years in a row, and I had to stop and think, what's wrong with me?
But it was a wonderful way to make tomato salad, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, yeah, but you have to eat it. It's already made.
Well, Tim, are you going to continue being some celebrity farmer, and will you continue to use that as material for your writing?
Or? Oh yeah, certainly. It's funny. I have I had friends come down Sunday, a chef friend of mine, and we keep talking about new ideas. I grew a lot of heirloom corn this year, and I took it. Last Wednesday, I took it into the kitchen at Gotham Bar and Grill, where the chef de cuisine there is from Mexico, and some of these varieties of corn he knew from Mexico. And,
oh, really?
And yeah, and it just goes on and on. So we talked for an hour about it. He was so excited to see these corns that he hadn't seen since he was in Mexico.
Yeah,
so
you have the same stories to tell over chiles, which you also grow.
Chile peppers, yeah.
It's
we grow
a
lot of chiles.
Rich,
and heirloom cucumbers, and yeah.
Heirloom cucumbers.
Yeah,
right,
I think
next.
So I was thinking in my mind, I'm going to continue to write about this.
All right.
So much.
Well, now, anybody who's interested in the book can go. It's listed on our website. So all you do is click on, and you get it. You order it. And do you have any any other comments, Tim, about the book or what you're doing next or anything for our listeners?
Yeah, just I think if you get a chance, read the book and otherwise visit your local farmer's market as much as you possibly can, because there's some amazing stories at every farm stand.
Oh, that's for sure. You get a lot of them into this book. Listeners, the book is also filled with memorable characters, and Tim does a fine job of
the people who've worked in the farm, the chefs, many of the chefs that I've sold to.
Yeah, you nail them, those descriptions just perfectly. So that adds another dimension to the book. Well, this has been a pleasure for us talking to you, Tim.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Right, and keep us posted on your next book.
Oh, certainly will.
I wish I had more of your tomatoes.
Come by. We're right off 78.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Ann.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, we talked to Tim forever. There's so many facets of his personality. But now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Well, now that we know that Tim's telling us he knows chefs want in produce, let's turn our attention to an entire book called Things Chefs Love. So let's listen to Marie Simmons tell us all about that.
I personally am totally in awe of anybody who's written over 20 cookbooks, and as our next guest has, Marie Simmons, welcomed on the menu.
Thank you for having me.
Marie is a cookbook author. She is a teacher, and she has this wonderful book out now that we're just going to be talking about called Things Cooks Love, and it is a beauty of a book, Marie.
Thank you so much.
But you're just such an incredible word. I mean, can we talk a little bit first about how it's possible to write 20 books?
Well, first of all, you have to love it.
Okay.
You have to love cooking. And, the actual cooking part comes very easily. I'm an intuitive cook, and I think I just have that by genetic predisposition. But the writing is more of a discipline. Sometimes I feel as if I have to tie myself to my desk chair to get, because it's very painstaking work. But especially recipe writing, the more creative writing, of course, is fun. But, you know, I look at, I go to a market and I look at a display of whatever it could be, produce or even meats or fish, and my head starts thinking of ways I'd love to taste it. It seems to me my gut and my head and my palate are all attached, and I'm just able to do that. And so I get in there, I have to touch the food, and I create dishes, and then I write them down. But I've been doing this for a very long time.
Well, this is I just thought the listeners might be interested in, you know, before they themselves get into the idea of saying, well, I must have one good cookbook inside of me. And, you know, just imagine what it's like to make a career out of 20. I'm really fascinated because on the front cover of this book is one of my absolute favorite kitchen tools, because it's yellow, whereas ours is blue, but it's an Emile Henry cast iron pot. Am I correct?
It's a enameled cast iron.
I had it wrong. Yeah, Emile Henry. Right?
I
think the brand is a stout. But
oh,
I think what you have
stout
to realize that there are many manufacturers of these particular books, and these particular tools. And the thing about Things Cooks Love, although it is cookware driven, it is not a catalog. It is a book about cookware with recipes for using
it. Yes, it's generic. You explained that to us. This is not an advertisement or a catalog, as you said. We should say that it's the first in the series to be actually published by Sir La Tavola, which has to be one of my most favorite cookware stores.
Yeah, I call it the toy shop for cooks.
Oh, yes, it
is. You walk in there, and it's floor-to-ceiling cookware. And you either, you know, your eyes glaze over, or you get an adrenaline rush, and you're just like, oh, I want this, I want this.
Oh,
but
sure.
This gets us to the point of, and Ann and I were talking about this before, she was asking me about, well, how did anyone get the idea for a book that is all about equipment and all about recipes and cooking? You know, where did this come from? Well, where it came from was the customers, the clients of Sur La Tavola stores, of which there are many across the country. they would come into the store and they would look at, you know, maybe a steamer insert. These are quality cookware. These are not, you know, just casual investments. These are lifetime investments for many people, and as many good pots are. And you know, and they would say, well, what else could I use this for? What can I make in this? You know, what is this? And so the people who work at the Solo Top stores are passionate cooks. And, I mean, it is the secret to their success. They can really communicate with the people who shop there. And they kept voicing the opinion to the people, you know, the powers that be at Sur La Table, that, you know, we need a book. We need something we can refer our customers to. And so over the years, this just snowballed into the idea, until the idea finally gelled. And they said, okay, this is what we want. They came to me. We had a relationship because I had been teaching there on and off for years. And they came to me and they said, you know, you're an experienced cookbook author. This is our idea. Could you write us a proposal for a book? And so this was a little daunting, but I'm the kind of person that it was absolutely so exciting for me. So I went to the Solo Table store near my home in Berkeley, California, and I just hung out, and I looked at all the equipment, and I took notes, and I tried to organize it in my head, and what ended up was this book with over 100 pieces, pieces of major cookware described. Well, actually, there's 60-plus pieces of cookware with detailed description, over 100 recipes, beautiful photographs.
And the recipes were generated by
me.
But they were
inspired by the cookware.
I would say that they were cookware generated, even though, I mean, your recipes.
Yeah, of course.
One relates to a particular piece of cookware.
Yes, and that's the way the book is divided.
Which I think is probably something that makes this stand out, because for years now, there's been a series out of the Culinary Institute of America on equipment, cooking equipment. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with it is that just when they get their definitive guide out, everything changes and it's out of date within a matter of a year.
Right. And that's why we wanted this to be what I like. In publishing, we use the word evergreen.
Yes.
Which means it's good for all seasons. It's always, you know, available. And so that was what we were looking at. So, for instance, for the roasting pan, you know, I talk about, you know, the sizes available, why you would want a certain size, what the sizes are good for. I give tips for using. I give how to take care of it. And then I always, for every piece of cookware, I list alternatives. So if there's a substitute, for instance, if you don't have a steamer insert with a big pot, well, what could you use instead? So I talk about, well, you know, there are these folding steamers that could be used for certain things. There are ways to gerrymand a steamer with a plate and a little, you know, rack, or, you know, and so I give people hints. And some of them were, say a bamboo steamer. I mean, you look at the beautiful photograph of these steamed Chinese dumplings and you say, oh, that looks great, but I don't have a bamboo steamer and I'm not about to buy one. What can I use? So I tell people, you know, how to improvise a bamboo steamer. So it's not a hard sell. It's a book about food, and it's a book about equipment and cookware, and it's a book for people who love good food.
Well, it's also a very handsome book. Who did the photography? It's exquisite.
Yeah, the photography is wonderful. And it was done in New York by Ben Fink, who is a very well-known food photographer. He does other photography as well. And the one thing about the book, too, is that it's very art-driven, in the sense that the designer of the book had a plan, and there's a continuity that's very pleasing to the person. You're not even aware of it unless you were close to the process, as I was. But if you look through the book, there is subtle repetition of a color pattern. So there's sort of a color card that was used. And so there are bronzes and golds and browns, and then with a little hit, and then yellows. And then here and there, there's a hit of turquoise, which is very pretty. And so it's a very beautiful book, heavy quality paper, and it opens up flat Isn't that wonderful when you're a cook and you want to bring this book into the kitchen?
Oh, yes.
Now, there's something else I noticed about it, Marie, which is the way it's organized, because you can approach it from several different angles, I guess. You have the angle that you suggested that it's organized by, oh, well, I just got this new piece of kitchen equipment and I want to know how to use it. And you have that in two areas, essential cookware and tools and then cooking with kitchen essentials. But then you take the rest of the approach of saying, but we'll do everything else by different cuisines trotting around the globe, from the Asian kitchen via the French kitchen, the Indian kitchen, to the Moroccan kitchen. And then last but not least, full index. So if you have this book on the shelf and you're just looking for a recipe for what it is you just bought this morning because you can't figure one out, you can also go in it that way. So you've got sort of three different ways of using it.
Yeah, which is very handy. It's a very user-friendly book. It is not, I'm very, I must say, I mean, I was immersed in this project for almost 2 years, and when I sort of, you know, came out from under, you know, you don't know what to think. I mean, that's the whole process of writing a cookbook. I mean, you know, it's manuscript pages. But when it finally is bound into a book and everything is pulled together, the text, you know, the photography, the art direction, and so on and so forth, I mean, I'm awed by what was done. You know, I'm just one small part of the team that really put this together, and it is quite wonderful and really fun. I mean, it's a wonderful feeling to finally hold it in your hands.
Yes, I wanted to emphasize that the essentials in the kitchen, essential implements and equipment, are one thing, but you also, I think, are very, very up to the very contemporary concept that we are all cooking globally now, so that you include things that most people maybe would not have included in the essential kitchen because of the our demand for cooking globally.
Well, the essential cookware and tools, that section is divided into two chapters. And the first chapter is the basic kitchen. So
exactly.
That's all the basic stuff. And then the second chapter is called well-stocked global kitchen.
That's it.
And these are, we talk about how, well, you know, this section is, includes, some pieces of equipment that you may not have in your kitchen, but if you're an enthusiastic cook, you know about and you might want to introduce.
Yeah, like a tagine and...
Right, and even a chinoise or a, a mandolin, a meat pounder, some of the more basic, some of the more a garlic peeler. Now, you don't have to have a garlic peeler, but if the, you know, you might be a person who finds, you know, peeling that garlic a nuisance. And
what is your most essential piece of equipment? I mean, I actually traveled to Australia when I was moving there with my garlic press that was absolutely essential to me.
That's interesting.
Yeah, but that was also in 1972 when there were probably at least six garlic presses in the whole of Australia, and all of those were in restaurant kitchens.
Right, exactly. And now we're, you know, one of the things that's happened in the meanwhile, of course, we have the microplane.
I love the microplane.
Yeah, which is probably the equivalent of what the garlic press was then.
There's so many of them. I just saw the expansion. In fact, I'm going to interview somebody from microplane, I think, pretty soon, because they have more than just that rasp now.
There's so many.
Yeah.
I mean, for cheese and all kinds of, you know, it's kind of sort of taken over for the greater. And I do in the next section of the book, it's called the On the Stove and in the Oven, and that's, you know, where all these are all the cookware like braisers and Dutch ovens and double boiler and so on. And then the next chapter in that is section that is handheld tools. And in that I have graters, and among the graters is, of course, the microplane. And then there's the four-sided grater that some people find indispensable.
And the five-sided grater.
And the five-sided grater and the one-sided grater.
But what's your most favorite piece of equipment?
Well, I was going to say the microplane. I really have learned to, you know, and it's funny you mentioned garlic. I don't use my garlic press anymore. I actually grate the garlic on my microplane.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it comes out almost the same as a press. You get the little tiny, tiny, juicy pieces.
Yeah, but you also probably got some nipped fingers there.
Well, you have to be very careful. And that's one of the things. My favorite grater is one I've had for years, and they do dull over the years. And so when they're duller, you're less apt the newer ones are much, much, much sharper.
Marie, we're actually running over time because there's so much to talk to you about. I may just call you again and just we'll chat.
Sure.
Listeners, the answer is get this book. Jamie Oliver says it's good. Mario Batali says it's good. Marcel Hazan has something to say about it. I don't know that she quite bring herself to say it's good. It's called Things Cooks Love, Implements, Ingredients, and Recipes. Marie Simmons, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a delight to talk to you.
It was a pleasure, and thank you both.
Thank you, Marie. Bye.
Bye.
And once again, it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Please don't forget to email us on the menu at onthemenuradio.com. I would love to have your comments and suggestions.
As long as they're printable.
Now, several years ago, I wandered into a blog called Waiter Rant, anonymously done. And sure enough, there appeared this year a book called Waiter Rant. And the waiter right now is not anonymous. He is out in the open. And you listen to the conversation we had with him.
I knew about Steve Duplonica long before I got his book. The book is called Waiter Rant, and that was his blog. Very interesting. Well, Steve, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you for having me in.
It's a complicated story, really. I mean, on the surface, it was presented as the kitchen confidential at the front of the house, and it really isn't. It's more a personal journey, isn't it?
I like to think of it as a mixture of both.
Uh-huh.
You know, you get a glimpse of what's going on behind the scenes, but also a large part of the story is me figuring out what I want to do when I grow up within a restaurant.
Yeah, Peter was asking me something about what your dream was that you were following, and I said, well, he wants to be a writer. I said, but actually, he wanted to be Pope first.
Yeah, I kind of lowered my sights just a tad.
You wanted to be the second Polish Pope, is that the deal?
Yeah, something like that, yeah, but that kind of flamed out early, so I think many people end up that way. They float around and they don't know what they want to do with themselves. And I mean, they can be married and have families and still have that feeling.
But you were really fascinated by the restaurant business. I mean, is that what got you going with waiting? Or
I don't think
it was the restaurant industry that was. It was staying in one place. You see, prior to working in the restaurant, I had never held a job longer than 2 years. I was being laid off, I was being fired, I was quitting. And when I worked at the Bistro, I actually stayed put for a long time. And staying put did two things. It made me frustrated that I didn't know what I wanted to do, but it also kind of focused me on day-to-day stuff that was occurring in the restaurant. And I didn't start blogging right away. I waited like almost 4 years before I started blogging. And then all of a sudden I realized I was recording all the little things that came in the door every night, and it was because I was in the one place that I was able to see that.
Now, who was it who took the photos from the same corner over and over again? Who was that in your book?
That was Harvey Keitel's character in the movie Smoke. That's okay. A wonderful movie. He took a picture of the same street corner every day for years, and it became a piece of art. Just by focusing on something small and mundane for a long time, he really showed the beauty of what was hidden there.
So, but you were showing the truth, at least, of what was hidden there by focusing on the head.
Yeah, some of it's not pleasant. I mean, you know, I was talking about, I mean, when I talk about my earlier restaurant experience, I talk about how workers are very often mistreated by management, and also that customers can be very cruel and very...
I've seen it.
Socially maladjusted. Well, you used to own a restaurant.
Yeah, I know.
people
but I see it even in somebody else's restaurant. You know,
yeah.
You just can't believe that people treat another human being that way.
And people look at me, and they've seen customers have conniptions. in the restaurant, and then people turn to me and go, how can you put up with that? How can you deal with that without breaking their neck? And I think that's where my, you know, I used to work in a psychiatric hospital when I was younger, so I dealt with really crazy people. I mean, people who had really had severe problems. I said, if I can handle them, I can handle a restaurant customer. So
yeah, I like the story of the woman with the stroke of the man demanding the table.
Yeah, I mean, that reminds me of the story of someone dropped out of a heart attack in a casino, and people were stepping over his body to get to the table. And that's a true story. And so people, I look at that, and these people were saying, well, we want that table. I just basically turned to them and said, you can sit where I seat you, or you can go home. I mean, these are your choices. And luckily, my owner was on vacation, so, because he would have caved.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I was the hammer in my restaurant. I was the guy who made the unpleasant decisions. Yeah.
I might say that in addition to getting a lot of behind the scenes info, some of it ugly, some of it not so ugly, you also have appendices. The first one being 40 tips on how to be a good customer. I found that interesting. I think that's something everybody should read.
Somebody said they're going to post it on the front door of their restaurant.
And then
I said put it in the bathroom on the door.
put a copy on every table. Why not?
Yeah, right. You have 50 ways to tell you're working in a bad restaurant. I mean, not everybody will want that information, but it's good.
Yeah.
And then I got a little lost in Appendix C with items a waiter should carry at all times or out close by.
Yeah, that was a little fanciful, you know. I mean, I'm not advocating that waiters carry guns. You know, I guess I have a firearm in your locker. You know, but I say that there are some things that waiters should come. I can't tell you how many times waiters would come into work and say, I forgot my wine opener.
Uh-huh.
I forgot my table crumber. I don't have any pens. And then, you know, and that's crazy. I don't have my dupe pad. You know, so there are things that you always should have. And then there's the things that I always say waiters will forget their openers and their dupe pads, but they'll always remember their cigarettes. You know,
yeah.
They'll never forget that. So, they don't have money to buy a new apron, but they got plenty of money to buy booze at the end of the night, so.
You know, I have a tipping question to ask you.
Shoot.
We're constantly in a situation because of what we do and the fact that I was the restaurant editor for City Magazine for 14 years. We travel. We go to restaurants and frequently get comp.
Mm.
You know, large bills, tasting menus, that kind of thing. And then we're confronted with what do you do with the tip?
Yep.
Now, I'm going to ask your opinion of it, and I mean, we've had the owner or chef react in different ways. If somebody says we're taking care of it, then we could be comfortable with that, right?
No.
Okay, but this is why I'm asking the question.
I think what happens is that you should ask what would have been the bill,
yeah.
Or get a ballpark and then leave 20%.
That seems a little crass. I mean, I'm trying.
I don't think it is. I personally, or you can.
We'll try to work it out. Yeah.
Yeah, or if you can work it out in your own head, if you say, well, you've been around, so you know the value of you know, okay, say some tasting menu at a fancy schmancy restaurant is going to be $100 and something per person. So you say it's a $200 and something check, and you leave $40-$50. And if you got it for free, give a little extra. But trust me, very often when the chefs or the owners say we'll take care of it, that means the waiter's not getting anything. Sometimes they are cool and give the waiter something, but it will never be as much as you will give.
Now, you have a section on tipping and people are really cheap and people are really generous. And I want to just feed off of that in a slightly different direction because almost all of your experience has been in the United States.
All of my waiting experiences have been in the United States.
Yeah, where people are big tippers compared to the rest of the world. One of the travel magazines just had a section on tipping around the world. And for example, in Australia, and this would surprise you, in Australia, waiters don't expect tips. In France, service is included, and the waiter is a salaried employee.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you react in those situations?
Well, basically, I knew about that, but in France and in Australia, they have protections that waiters do not enjoy in this country. They have a salary. They have health care.
Yeah, that's a big.
They have vacation. They have sick time. They have recourse if their rights are violated. In the United States, with very few exceptions, the only waiters are paid in New York State $4.60 an hour. In North Carolina, they're paid $2.13 an hour. So tips constitute the bulk of their income.
Okay, fair enough.
And they have no health care, no vacation, no...
Did you read that book, Nickel and Dime?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
great,
yeah.
Book.
Yeah, great book.
Yeah.
So, now, okay, so for readers, we'll get a different view of restaurants. They may have a different attitude about the experience of dining out from this book and get specific tips from you. Back to you. You still run your blog?
I still run my blog. Like I said, I've been really busy the past couple of weeks, so I'm not writing out as much as I would like to, but
and
I
it's
do
called
maintain it.
WaiterRant.net.
Yeah, the book is Waiter Rant, Thanks for the Tip, Confessions of a Cynical Waiter, so it's not too different.
Now, here's a question. Why did you write it anonymously? I mean, there's been a lot of controversy over, for example, that book, Primary Colors, which was written by a journalist called Joe Klein, and it took him a long time to come out of the closet, and you wrote yours also blind. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, one of the criticisms I've gotten from people is that I was a coward.
I'm not being in the least bit critical. I'm just asking.
Oh, I know you're not.
I'm just asking what went through your mind.
But I think one of the things that helps, you know, I think anonymity is a shield. The Supreme Court had a decision once, and they say anonymity is a shield from the tyranny of the majority, and that was about anonymous pamphleteering. And, you know, in our country, you know, Common Sense by Thomas Paine was done anonymously.
Yes.
And the reason why he did it anonymously, because he didn't want to get hung. It was very simple.
Although many people thought maybe he should have been anyway.
Yeah, and you're right. And so, you know, and here I was, certainly not playing for those stakes, but I said, I could lose my job. This is how I feed myself, put a roof over my head. I could not afford to be this, you know, person, because trust me, I've gotten some nasty emails from customers who've read the book, and they've said, my old customers, you know. So I have no doubt what their reaction would have been if I was exposed. They would have asked for me to be removed from the restaurant. The owner may not have had any choice. So yeah, being anonymous. So when Joe Klein wrote his book, he would not have been able to write it, you know, as Joe Klein. He had to write it. It freed him up to do what he needed to do, but then he had the wherewithal to say, yeah, I'm the guy.
Now, were you really discovered by Russell Crowe? I mean, did he?
Yeah, it's a true story.
Funny.
Yeah, he was making a movie nearby, and he came into the restaurant several times, and I wrote up a story about one of his visits, and then a couple of nights later, he came into the restaurant, and he said, so you're that guy from that blog.
Yeah.
And I was like, so I was anonymous really until a couple of weeks ago, but the only guy who ever confronted me, ever, I at one point had 2 million readers a month, the only guy who ever confronted me in the restaurant was Russell Crowe, and I always thought that's just stranger than fiction.
Well, didn't he like to throw things anyway?
Oh, you know what, I don't know what that's about. When he was with me, he was well behaved and a good tipper. I had no problems with Russell
Crowe. But he did have a number of incidents where he threw
things. He did. He had some kind of incident with the bellhop in New York City.
Hmm.
Yeah, but you know what? You know, who knows? Who knows what happened? Yeah. Who knows what happened with our
stuff? Well, Steve, what are you doing now? And are you now? Have you decided that you're actually a writer and you're going to continue writing?
I'm certainly trying to do that, and I'm discussing what my next project is going to be with my publisher, and trying to come to we got a couple irons in the fire, we got some ideas. And the success of the book is kind of like, we're like, oh wow, we're on the bestseller list. We didn't expect that. Well, they might have. I certainly didn't. So
this is the kind of thing the public eats up.
Yeah.
I see a movie in here.
Russell Crowe should play me.
I was going to ask you, who should play you when that happens? Are you sure it would be Russell Crowe?
I don't think anyone wants to gain the weight to play the role. I said Ed Norton. Someone said, a film guy I know said Ed Norton would be perfect to play you, and I said he's got to like 30 pounds on his frame before he's supposed to play me. Like method acting, like De Niro and Raging Bull. But I don't know. If I ever saw my story up on the screen, it would be such a surreal experience.
Well, it's coming. We have Bottle Shock right now. We've had Sideways before. Who knows what might come? I think you ought to think about it.
Well, Paul Giamatti might be a good person to play. I saw him in Sideways and loved the movie, but hated the fallout from the Merlot.
Yeah, so he's just the right kind of sort of desperate, unfortunate looking look.
That's me. There you go. That's perfect.
We have a favorite friend who is a waiter. He's waited at every restaurant in Pittsburgh, and wherever we go, suddenly he'll be there, and he'll always make sure that takes over our table. It doesn't matter if we're entirely over the opposite side of the restaurant; he will still take over our table. But I said to Ann once, I said, you know what? If Doug wasn't a waiter, he'd make a fabulous undertaker. there's something incredibly Uriah Heepish about.
Well, I mean, okay, you're a good customer. Ann's
looking shocked. I'm hoping Doug's not a listener to the program.
Yeah, he's like, oh, no. No, it sounds like, you know, I had customers like that, and wherever they would sit, I would tell the waiter, that's my table.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, listen, Steve, I wish you a lot of luck. It's been fun talking to you. I enjoyed your book.
Thank you.
Anybody who's interested in the reality of a restaurant and also in experiencing the restaurant from the other side, and maybe getting a little bit more enlightened about what you do in the restaurant and pay more attention to interaction with the staff of the restaurant, should get Waiter Rant. Thanks for the tip, Confessions of a Cynical Waiter. And I believe it's already on our website.
It absolutely is. So listeners, OTM bookshelf, and do a find on this page for Waiter Rant, and away you go. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. And read it from cover to cover, and I'm sure you'll be equally fascinated.
Yeah.
And Steve, you've been a great guest.
Good luck to you, Steve.
Okay, well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
And now it's time for another break.
Or as we say, pause for the cause, and we hope you'll join us again on the other side. There's something good coming up. I can't remember what it is, but you'll find out.
I know.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Well, Ann said she knew what was coming up after the break, because she always knows what's coming up after the break, so why don't you tell us, sweetheart?
Yes. Well, you've had tips on produce, you've had tips on technique, you've had tips on tips, and now we're going to get tips on how to store cheese from Jeff Roberts.
On the Menu welcomes Jeff Roberts to the program. Hello, Jeff.
Good afternoon, Ann. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm just debating which of your many titles I should use by way of introducing you. I think we'll start with co-founder and principal consultant to the Vermont Institute for Artisan Cheese and author of The Atlas of American Artisan Cheese, because we're going to be talking about cheese today.
So that's why it's on the program. But you're also a historian and a meteorologist and a few other things, too.
Yeah, I mean, he has a company called Cow Creek Creative Ventures, which is a consulting company. He has, which kind of lets him do all the different things that he wants to do. He consults in architecture, history, and land use. He's focusing on agriculture. You're a Slow Food USA active member. What else? I mean, we could go on and on and on. You must be a very antsy kind of personality, eager and energetic.
Well, thank you for all of that. Yes, and I'm also just very curious about the world. I like to discover new things, and I've always had an ability to focus on something that really caught my interest and learn something about.
So how come cheese?
I like to eat.
Okay, and you especially like to eat cheese.
Well, yes, but I'm an omnivore. Uh-huh. I eat just about anything. I'm not quite like the Chinese, but I enjoy good food, and really throughout my life, food has had an important place for making friends, for entertaining, for being with family. I know that some of my interests and roots go back to both sides of my family, Italian-American on my mother's side and Jewish-American on my dad's side.
Both good eaters.
Oh, yes. Great and great cooks all the way around.
And somewhere along the way, someone must have served you cheese that wasn't stored correctly.
Well, there's a very funny story, which actually is a great segue.
Go ahead.
My great uncle owned a delicatessen in Ford, New Jersey.
Oh.
And during the Depression, one of the neighborhood kids came in with a nickel and said to my uncle, my mother wants some Italian cheese. And my uncle pulled out this big wheel of Parmigiano Reggiano and said, here, kid, sniff it. And that was what he got for his nickel.
That's good.
But, you know, there's a cheese that, if not properly wrapped, will lose its great quality. And you can't wrap or store every cheese in the same way, because you can end up harming, in some cases, turning a wonderful product into something you wouldn't want to eat.
So first thing to worry about is wrapping then. So let's talk about wrapping for just a second.
Well, let's actually step back even further.
Okay.
To when and how you may be buying a cheese.
Okay, go ahead.
Today, it's very easy to, even a place like Pittsburgh or New York, where you can buy direct from a farm, a cheese maker. They sometimes will have their cheeses already wrapped and packaged. Worth asking, hey, when I get this home and I open it, what should I do?
Mm-hmm.
And ask the cheesemaker for advice, because they know how that their particular product will best happen.
Okay, now let's suppose instead of that I go to a cheese store, which we do regularly. We buy from Whole Foods, which wraps exclusively in plastic film.
Right.
We buy from Pennsylvania Macaroni Company, where they put the cheese on, I guess it's a wax paper sheet, and then they wrap it in a plastic bag. No, they always, both of them do it exactly the same way. Is there something that's going wrong here already?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Let's also look at the types of cheese that you could buy.
Okay.
Buy very fresh cheeses that have a fair amount of moisture in. And if you were to wrap something like that tightly in plastic wrap, the cheese no longer, and what happens is that the good bacteria and molds can't work, and so you end up with a product that starts to go bad. And I'm sure every one of us had an experience where you opened the cheese that had been wrapped and it smells like ammonia.
Oh yes.
Okay, and that's because if it's that kind of cheese, it's been wrapped too tightly.
There are a number of different ones that if you wrap them in properly like that, what you do is you take a cheese that normally is in an oxygen environment. You wrap it in plastic and you're depriving it of oxygen. So the anaerobic molds or bacteria now kick in, and they're the ones that can create some of these real off flavors and aromas.
Okay, now.
And if it looks sort of reddish, the mold is the wrong kind of mold, right?
It could very well be.
Now let's go to the other end of the scale. Let's suppose now we have a fine blue cheese like a Gorgonzola or a Roquefort.
And those cheeses, off even at a store like Whole Foods or even a Wegmans or the small chain that you have around Pittsburgh, you'll notice that those cheeses have tin foil, aluminum foil on the exterior. That's the way they are often shipped, completely wrapped in aluminum foil. When I get a cheese like that home that has been wrapped in plastic, I immediately take it out and I wrap it in some aluminum foil.
Okay, well that makes a whole lot of sense. Now let's go on to step two. Step two is another major problem in a climate like the one in the United States. Now I should backdrop this by saying I grew up in England, and when we used to store cheese, it was stored on a stone table in the basement at a temperature of about 45 to 50 degrees centigrade, and it lasted just fine.
Well, I hope it wasn't centigrade.
I should have said Fahrenheit. Fahrenheit was what I meant. They switched to centigrade now just to get everybody confused. So the cheese kept very well in that environment. Now, we've got the difficulty that here, when you serve a cheese, we served a piece of Dauphinois for a dinner party just a few days ago. The ambient temperature was about 90 degrees Fahrenheit, and the cheese almost ran off the edge of the cheese board.
It was funny. I'd never seen anything quite like it in my life. It was a pool.
It tasted absolutely delicious. It was just the right consistency and temperature. But then when we were done with it, we had to store it, so we had to put it in the refrigerator. Now, I know this is sort of a mistake, but what alternative do we have?
Well, in that particular instance, I would be using a wax paper.
Okay.
And that's a cheese, once it started to run, that this is true for almost any cheese that we buy and that we bring home. Once a cheese is cut, it doesn't continue to mature. However, it can continue to break down because you have active molds and bacteria that are working on the cheese. In the case of the cheese you just described, because it got very runny, that I would literally scrape it up, put it onto wax paper so that there is some air that gets in, so that the undesirable bacteria don't start working on it, and I'd put it in the refrigerator. What we have to protect against in most refrigerators used in the United States that are called frost-free, those refrigerators are designed to remove humidity from the inside environment, both your freezer section and your regular refrigerated section. Low humidity is an enemy of good cheese. And so wrapping helps to keep some of the moisture that's in the cheese intact. For a well-aged hard cheese, those I will wrap, sometimes even a double layer of plastic wrap, cut down on how much moisture escapes from that cheese.
Okay, because that's one of the things you do. Now, does the fact that you're refrigerating it itself spoil the cheese?
Not necessarily. But
when you say not necessarily, I mean, it has some effect that's not desirable.
It can.
Okay.
Generally, our refrigerators are somewhere between 37, 38 degrees up to maybe 42 or 43 degrees. So it's not as, it's colder than what you were describing in England. I would also imagine that the cheese that you had in the basement was in a more moist environment.
Oh, yes.
Which helped.
So I mean, do people have to invest in a cheese refrigerator? I mean, we've heard of restaurants which have those, and they keep it at a temperature of about 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's just about perfect, I guess.
Yes, but not every cheese wants to be in a really humid environment. What I recommend, if a person is really concerned about a cheese turning, regardless of what style it is not to buy pounds of a particular cheese. Buy less, use it up, and go back to the store and get more, because there, more likely than not, the retailer has proper refrigeration and humidity where they're storing cheese, so that you can rely on them. I have cheese in my refrigerator that I've had for a number of weeks. They tend to be either blue or an aged cheese like a cheddar or an aged sheep cheese, but they're tightly wrapped. The things like a cheddar, they're tightly wrapped. Last.
Now, where do you stand on the issue of raw cheese?
Oh, I eat it all the time. In the United States, the regulations say that if you're going to produce or import a raw milk cheese, that it has to be aged for a minimum of 60 days at no less than 37 degrees Fahrenheit.
Which can screw up the cheese.
I'm sorry?
That you can screw up some cheeses like that.
Well, you could, but there's an assumption that when a cheese has been aged, this is true, frankly, for raw milk as well as pasteurized, that a variety of good things happen to that cheese. What we know from research that my colleagues at the Vermont Institute for Artisan Cheese have been conducting is that that raw milk cheese is very safe. The number of instances of foodborne illnesses attributed to cheese that the Centers for Disease Control have documentation for count on two hands over 50 years.
I agree with you.
So the problem is the USDA is really, in this case, ill-advised in their regulations.
Well, I didn't say that.
Oh, you
what
didn't
I
say
said
that. Okay.
Was
right.
That the regulations that are in place, which require us to age cheese for 60 days before we can sell a raw milk cheese product, those regulations have worked. We have a variety of pasteurized cheeses made in the United States by artisan producers that are among some of the best in the world. And I've done tastings in Europe using pasteurized product that the Europeans could not distinguish from a raw milk product. So that to me tells me that our producers just have great skill to make a terrific product.
Now, Jeff, I mean, you have so much information. I wanted to ask you if people could go to this website and learn a whole bunch of stuff about Jesus that they might not know.
To the Vermont Institute website?
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Do you want to give us that?
Well, right off the top of my head, I'd have to go and look. But it would be the Vermont Institute for Artisan and Cheese. If it's placed into a search engine,
okay,
it'll come right up. It's part of the University of Vermont.
Oh, okay, that's good to know.
And so my colleague, our faculty, they're some of the best known scientists working in the dairy community and working on cheese. It's a very unique institute. There isn't anything else like it in the United States.
Well, I'm totally enamored of Vermont. I can't tell you how many producers from Vermont we've interviewed.
And authors. Yeah, and it's just been great to have you dispel some myths for us and also give us sound advice that will allow us to make sure that the money we spend on this wonderful delicacy called cheese is money well spent. So, and any last thought on cheese for our listeners, aside from eat more cheese?
Well, besides that, the variety of products available in the United States today, in my opinion, rival what you find in Europe, and in some cases are better product than what are being sent to the United States, because so much of the demand from America for European product has resulted in the expansion of industrial cheese in Europe. So we do not see, for example, true Brie or Camembert from France.
Yes.
I don't eat it. I haven't eaten any in years.
Yeah.
I buy a Brie style or a Camembert style from local cheesemakers here in Vermont.
Yeah, we are lucky to have a whole bunch of them in Vermont, too.
And those products get shipped around the country, and they're far better than what you see, than what I could buy or would want to buy from France.
Well, we're just awed to have been in the presence of such an expert on cheese, and we hope that you'll keep
and
up
everything else.
and you'll keep up the great work. And if you have anything new and exciting that you discover, or you or your colleagues discover, please make sure to get in touch with On the Menu so that you can join the program again and share it with us.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it. Good eating. Good discoveries to you and your audience.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
Bye.
Wow, that sure was a fascinating program. Lots and lots of good information all the way from the very beginning to the end.
Right. And I guess it's time now to call it quits for the day.
It is. We ran over 60 minutes again. We were having so much fun, but never mind. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. Same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.